Hello, 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 and welcome back to The Straight Shot. I'm your host, as always, Fionn Mac School, and episode number 12, guys. Time marches on, so does the podcast. Slowly, slowly, catchy monkey. That's what I was told once by a Filipino guy, and it's been sticking with me ever since. This is actually my second time recording this episode. I did a recording last night, Friday night. Something I've been kind of meaning to do for quite some time. That's an episode while I'm drinking beer. Now, the episode itself was actually okay. It's just I shot myself in the foot a couple of times, accidentally pressed pause in the recording, and I don't know how much I lost. Mr. Check came home. I thought he was gone for the night, and I was recording in my kitchen, and so that was interrupted. And I like putting on a straight shot. I like putting on an uninterrupted show. And so I said I'd record again. Also, I got a new laptop. Thank God, the other one was really, really starting to struggle on me there. As you probably heard at the end of the episode number 11, there was twice that I missed the pause. Essentially, what was happening is, as I said in that episode, that you can kind of tell when the laptop was kind of on the verge of giving out, and how you'd tell that is by looking at the millisecond bar, and if the milliseconds started flickering or wavering, then you knew something might be happening. It didn't guarantee it. It's only when the seconds started flickering and pausing that you knew you had to hit pause. And I kind of felt that it was affecting the whole episode I did the last time, that I was focused on the millibar the whole time, the millisecond bar the whole time. And I felt that it kind of blocked the fluidity of the points I was trying to make, of the story I was trying to transmit. So, it was really driving me crazy. So I bit the bullet and I bought a new laptop, and this thing is crisp. Oh my golly, I'm delighted. I'm really delighted. And I had been planning doing another episode, but I got excited about the new laptop. You know how you are with a new toy. And so I just wanted to belt out a quick recording. And the one I did last night was an easy enough one. I'd intended it to be easy enough because I was doing an experimental kind of podcast, where I was having a couple of beers and recording, something that I've been kind of avoiding thus far. I find sometimes it's hard to keep your wits about you if you're after an alcoholic beverage and you're trying to focus on something like recording a podcast. But last night went all right, just barring the couple of technical idiot issues. Here I am recording again. So I am going to maybe do another episode for the beer episode. This one is just going to be a nice sober one. Today I'm down in my work. I'm in the canteen again. I think I did which one was it? Number 4, if I remember correctly. I did it in the canteen in work. And that's a nice sound in here. It's a nice small room. Relatively quiet. Very little traffic on a Saturday. And I said I'd redo what I recorded last night. The beer I was drinking last night, rather controversially, sorry, just fixing the microphone here. The beer I was drinking was Dutch Gold, which is, I suppose, controversial. A lot of people don't like Dutch Gold or give out about it quite a lot. I love the stuff. Absolutely love Dutch Gold. I find it extremely refreshing. But I suppose I drink other beers as well. I love Carlsberg. I love San Miguel. Maybe the Grolschka is lovely. Tisky's not bad. But my favorite beer, I think, is St. Augustiner. It's a German beer, Munich. Absolutely divine. Hard to get in Ireland. Very hard to get. In fact, I can only think of one or two places that would have it. Whenever they do, they're always sold out because it's just that nice. excuse me. No COVID. So, I'm here at my new laptop. Unfortunately, I have no beer. I do have a Vitit, though. Vitit Boost. You know that, my favorite. I'm going to take a swig of it now. Delicious. Great way to wet the whistle if your mouth's getting dry. Now, beer is also a very good way to wet aforementioned whistle as well, but I'm driving, so I'm not going to be drinking today. So, as I said, we'll do the beer episode another day. Something I ended up talking about last night, I didn't know what I was going to be talking about. I just started talking, essentially. And where the conversation kind of took me was along the lines of the Costa Concordia. Now, how I got there, I suppose, is less important than actually getting there, because I ended up talking about, I talked for about 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes about the Costa Concordia and the, you know, and a phenomena that's often discussed in maritime accident investigation. There's a whole thing I recommend you checking out, MAIB, the Marine Accident Investigation Bureau. And they are, I suppose, a fascinating read. You'd be amazed, absolutely amazed, how these accidents can occur. So this error chain, the logic behind it is, if at any stage the chain was broken, the accident wouldn't have occurred. And look, it's not a faultless logic. It has its gaps, like, but sorry, scratching my eye, it's still jaded. Had too much touch gold last night. But the purpose of the marine accident investigation is that you analyze what happened, obviously, and figure out where you can break that chain in the future. Now, I'm going to go into a bit more depth today than I did last night about the Costa. So essentially, I'm going to be very vague, relatively vague with this. I don't want to get bogged down in technical things. Like, I got bogged down the last episode. I think I got talking too much about technical stuff. And I do believe that visual aids can describe these things far more proficiently than, say, you know, just verbally describing it. But so that's why I'm going to try to be slightly vague, I suppose, might be the word. Just more general, as opposed to going into the nickety bits, but there is a couple of kind of technical things I will have to mention, for they are worth mentioning. So the Costa Concordia was doing something that a lot of cruise ships do, and it's called a scenic sail by, or a scenic sail pass, or something like that. And the general concept of it is that you, the cruise ship, you know, the crew of a cruise ship, and the managers and the directors of the cruise ship company like to provide a really good service, a unique service for their passengers. And this generally leads to navigational phenomena that other vessels in the maritime industry would avoid. So a good example would be, say, you're coming out of Cork Harbour, a south-facing harbour, and you come out and you drop your pilot, you drop the local guy that is helping you navigate out through the trickier waters of Cork Harbour, and you will have a big, juicy, full-away and passage waypoint that, you know, you've just dropped off the pilot. From this waypoint, you're striking off your line, your course to follow to get your next destination. So let's say Brazil, you know, you come out of Cork and you just head south, southwest, or whatever the course might be, and off you go down to Brazil. You generally try to keep as far away from land as you humanly can. You have to come close, but at some stages when you're transiting out of the river and out of the harbour, that's unavoidable. But generally speaking, after that, you try to avoid it as much as you can, keep safe distances off shore and whatnot. What's a safe distance? Well, that's a big question. That's a very legally marred question, because, you know, safe distances are mean different things for different ships. But generally speaking, oil tankers, cargo, this type of thing, they try to, you know, keep as far away from the land as possible and keep to the deep blue sea. You know, obviously geography and the route that you take is going to have a drastic effect on that. But cruise ships are a different animal. Cruise ships sometimes sail close to the land on purpose. And the reason why they do that is they want to provide a product to the customer, the passenger, the person paying for the ticket on board. And it's a lovely thing to sail nice and close to cliffs and islands and this and that. You know, the passengers love it. And it's a feat of navigational prowess. I mean, all of these cruise ship companies in particular hire and have very capable deck officer cards. You know, during my time in college, I was always impressed by the cruise ship lads' ability with the navigation. They really do pay attention to it, and these scenic sail bys happen quite a lot. they're a nice thing. You're showing off, essentially. But you're of a level of professionalism that these things are actually rather safe. They're well-checked, monitored and all this. But things can go wrong. And obviously that's what went wrong with the Costa Concordia. No, I won't go into the full error chain. There's a lot there and I can't remember. There was an awful lot there. But there was a few... three or four major things I'm going to talk about. And that led to this, led to the incident, or had a, were things that you mightn't have necessarily heard in the news, things that you mightn't have necessarily heard about or read about in articles and whatnot. It's maybe more things that a guy who's done a bit of navigating in the past might zero in on a bit more than a landlubber like yourselves. But something that really stuck out for me was how they managed their passage plan. So a passage plan, if you're if you're an innuendous person, might be getting a chuckle out of that because they say passage. But a voyage plan. A voyage plan might be a might be a more less giggly way to phrase it. But like I think I mentioned elsewhere what a voyage plan is. You've analysed your route and you're dropping waypoints on your chart, on your map. You have your waypoints plugged into your GPS. You have your waypoints on your electronic charts if you have them. And what a waypoint is, it's just a latitude and longitudinal position that you can strike off, and you know that's where you initiate a turn, say, or it's an important part of your plan where you're crossing a certain reporting line, this type of thing. You know, if you're, it's to this waypoint that you're calculating your estimated time of arrival, and you know, giving that report to the powers that be and whoever needs that report. But sometimes you can deviate from this voyage plan, and that's actually perfectly fine. Sometimes you know, things change, and you know, as a second officer, as a navigation officer, you're well used to and sometimes expect these changes, and how you implement these changes is very, very important. So as far as I'm aware, they weren't intending on doing this scenic sail by next to this island, which they bumped into. it was kind of a, I think it was a case of that there was one of the directors for the company, or there was someone who knew someone in the company, was standing ashore and was going to be mightily impressed by seeing this lovely, great, big ship sailing so close past. And with this voyage plan idea, you really have to put an awful lot of thought into where you're turning and how you're turning. The reason why so because of this is you have to anticipate and allow for some potential catastrophes or failures that could lead to the ship being imperiled. And this is going to be one of the most technical elements that I am going to describe to you, hopefully. I hopefully don't mess it up. It's a little bit tricky to describe. It's much easier to talk to discuss with the visual aid, but we'll give it a go. So I don't know if it's written somewhere, or if I always just taught it, or if it's something I picked up along the way. But as far as you best can, as far as practicable, you if you have to make a turn, and that turn leads you facing land, if you can do that turn beforehand, that means you're not facing into land, that you're facing into open water. That's a much better way to initiate a out of voyage plan turn. So they were going along the coast of the island. That was the plan. They initiated their turn very close to the island. So close, in fact, that... we'll try this. They were heading north. They were going north. Pottering north. And what they should have done is they should have altered their course to port, miles and miles and miles away from the island, and then come back around onto this parallel track that would have brought them in the scenic sail by. So you do your turn before you got near the island, and then you come back on track, and then for the whole approach to the island, you're on the track that you need to be. There's no more alterations of course needed. It's just an adjustment of course to maintain your course over the ground. And they didn't do this. They turned at a waypoint that sent them facing straight into the island. And if something went wrong, they lost steering, they lost engine control, their momentum would have taken them into the island. If they'd initiated this turn 5 miles away and something went wrong, nothing would have gone wrong, really. They'd have overshot their waypoint. They'd have overshot it into open water. So they overshot their turn, and they overshot their turn into an island. Now, how do you overshoot your turn? Well, interestingly, on a cruise ship, there is many, many different factors that you need to consider compared to, let's say, just a dirty old bulker or oil tanker or something. And one of those things you need to consider is how much a ship leans when you turn. So all ships lean. If you do a hard turn, they're going to lean away from the turn. I heard it described once, the difference between a ship and a boat is which way she leans when she turns. If you imagine a rib or a speedboat skipping along the water, when they turn, say they're turning to starboard, their starboard side dips down. When a ship is turning to starboard, they lean away from the turn. A boat leans into a turn, a ship leans away from a turn. And if you initiate a hard turn on a big ship, she'll really, really, really lean. A good angle over 5-10 degrees, sometimes even more if you're going faster and you're tall. And this particular cruise ship was going fast and they're very tall. So they have a rudder limit rudder limit on the autopilot. So this limit is there to stop people's wine and soup and beer and dinner going flying off the table because someone initiated a very sharp turn. So this is set into the autopilot. It's a presetting that you can adjust. It's very adjustable. But because this was an out of voyage plan turn, the wheel over point was at a default setting, which is very, very low. So if you have a low rudder angle limit, you're limiting the rate at which you can turn. The turn limit is set to keep the ship as flat and as stable as possible. You factor in a much wider arc of turn. You calculate that and you put that onto your chart, and your electronic chart can do it automatically. You just have to change the setting and it will tell you, and you can either calculate on a paper chart or the computer will tell you when you need to start turning your wheel to follow this exaggerated and enlarged arc of turn. But because it was ad hoc, they never reset the wheel over point on the electronic chart. It was set to much, much, much too small limit. They'd have had to do a hard over nearly to get the turn that they was prescribed, and they overshot their turn. They initiated the course change, and the autopilot was set at this limited rate of turn, and they turned far, far, far too slowly. Now, this sounds like nonsense. This sounds like stupidity. How can you not miss this? Well, look, okay, if you've like 50 waypoints and you're doing something just off the fly, it might be easy to miss. Where the problem really kind of came out was, and this is the one that really caught my eye, there is a process to determine who is in charge or who is the con at the time. And the captain was on the bridge, but the captain didn't have the con. So the captain always has the charge of a ship. The captain is always responsible for the ship, no matter what happens. Legally speaking, it's always his fault, even if he'd nothing to do with it. But to say he'd nothing to do with it is no-goer either, because the captain has to know everything and, you know, be involved in everything nearly. But he was on the bridge. Now, controversially, people say he was drunk and people say he had a lovely lady with him. And look, okay, that's not actually unusual. No, the drunk thing is a different story. You don't want the captain drunk. But, you know, a captain after a drink, bringing a couple of guests on the bridge, that isn't unusual. To take it at face value, say, let's say he wasn't drunk. Let's say he was just after one or two. And let's say this lovely lady wasn't a girl he was gavin giddy up with and was just instead a guest that the captain invited onto the bridge post-dinner to see this lovely scenic sail by that he knew was scheduled from the most prominent point on the ship, which is the bridge. This is the nerve center, you know, and you get to see all the radars and that. And it's really, really fancy. I love the ships. Bridges are just cool. They're really, really cool, man. I mean, they nearly sometimes remind you of Starship Enterprise or something like that. Less cool seats, but they have pretty cool seats, but they're not as cool as Jean-Luc's class timeless chair. But the captain was on the bridge, but he didn't have the con. He never said, "I have the con." So the con is, when I mentioned the pilot earlier, and I've talked about it in a previous episode, I'm sure. The pilot is a local guy that comes on board the ship that knows the area very well and has a lot of experience with a vast array and portfolio of different ships. And so he is, he doesn't take charge of the ship when he comes on board, but he takes the con. And so he's the guy telling the helmsman what to put on the wheel. He's the guy telling the captain to reduce speed or increase speed. And, you know, there's a measure of trust there. But at any stage, the captain can override the pilot, saying, "Okay, pilot, you no longer have the con." Right? The pilot will say, "I no longer have the con. Captain has the con." And that's recorded on the voyage data recorder, microphone system, amongst other things that records all things on the ship. So if a disaster happens, the last 24 hours are saved and the error chain is then preserved. So people can analyze it and scrutinize it at a later date to ascertain what happened and stop it from happening in the future, essentially. But when the captain came on the bridge, he never took the con. He never said he had the con. The officer of the watch, which I think was the third officer, he still had the con. No, it wasn't clear to him. He was new. It would be clear to someone who maybe had more experience that the captain was just floating around the place and, you know, showing off to the guests, which is part of the process of a cruise ship. You have to make the guests feel special, and there's nothing wrong with that. I actually think that's a rather nice thing to, you know, this person coming on a holiday getting extra special treatment. No, she could be getting extra, extra special treatment, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'm taking this at face value. And so when it became evident that this turn was going far too slow, there was a moment of panic, essentially, and everyone shut up. And you know, they should have gone hard over, hard to starboard, maybe far sooner, and let everyone's soup and drink spill, essentially. But they didn't. And there was another very tragic mistake in this process as well. I don't know, was it long before or after dinner? I can't remember the exact time of day, but there was a lot of work going on down below decks. This ship was so big that it had its own forklift, you know, and this forklift was going through a very integral watertight door. Now, this watertight door is so big that it can allow a forklift carrying a pallet of food through. That's a big, big door. And I don't know, was it left open or latched open or something like that? And so they were turning too slow and they bounced off this rock. And the rock cut her open. And you know, I mentioned quite a few things there, and if any of them were different, the disaster wouldn't have happened. But the door was open, and the gash happened, and a ship carries an awful lot of momentum. When she struck the rock, I think she immediately went dead in the water, blacked out. A sharp shudder, like a sharp kinetic force like that, can knock things out, and I think it knocked the engine out. And they essentially bounced off this rock and its momentum carried her out to sea. Now, luckily, very luckily, I don't want to minimize or, you know, make light of all the people that died in that ship that night, but they got hit by a bullet and dodged a missile, is how I think I phrased it last night. If I'm not, I meant to double check this, but if I'm not mistaken, the prevailing winds, the way the wind normally blows, and in that area at that time of year, is southwesterly. So it's coming from the south. The wind comes from the southwest, blowing to the northeast. I think that's the prevailing wind for that type of area. And so if you're looking at a north-south orientated chart, the wind would be coming from the lower left-hand corner, essentially. and they were traveling north. They were traveling northwest, bounced off the rock, and started traveling northeast and northeasterly. And if the prevailing winds were the southwesterly that day, the wind would have carried her off out to sea. And the damage was such that she was always going to capsize. Oh, noisy car. The damage was such, as far as I'm aware, that she was always going to capsize. Now, the wind that day was a northeasterly, so the wind actually pushed her back onto the rocks where she capsized. She capsized ashore. She capsized onto the rocks. And that might find that that might be sound to you kind of like worse, you know. Oh my God, at least in the water you can flow up onto rocks, you get crushed and smashed and all this. And like, you know, the idea of a ship going up in the rocks is something that as a seafarer, I'm sure every seafarer has had to have contemplated. There, we drill for it, we prepare for it, there's emergency plans for it, there's, you know, you do XYZ if this happened. But if the prevailing wind was as such as it should have for the rest of the time, she'd have been blown out to sea. And if she capsized at sea, she'd have sank. And anyone else in her, stuck in her, would have been taken with it. Now, as it stands, she capsized onto the shore and she didn't sink. And that allowed people that were lower down the chance to get out. So it could have been a hell of a lot worse. And I don't want to be mitigating or minimizing the people who died. It's an absolute tragedy, and the behavior of the captain was shocking. I mean, that's what a lot of people felt, at his behavior was shock. That resonated throughout the maritime industry as well, let me assure you. Utter shock. But by God, they got lucky. They got so lucky. If the wind blew them off, there'd have been a lot more people died. And like, so it is like, you know, the maritime industry. I mean, like, so these scenic sail pasts are, as I said, relatively regular as far as I'm aware. And it's a testament to the navigational skill of the bridge teams and all these other ships that don't crash and don't get into trouble, that they can do this. This feat of navigational prowess, essentially. And it practically always turns out okay. Do I think scenic sail pasts should be banned in the future? I don't think so. I know people are calling me a fool for that, but I do believe that after the Costa Concordia, a sharper eye should be put on the process that we do these things. I've done them, and, you know, we learned, I could actually see in the passage plan, the voyage plan, the lessons learned from the Costa Concordia, because she happened long before I ever stepped near a cruise ship. So, but you do hear these horrible stories, like, you've seen them all over the place in fire plans and buildings, that if a fire occurs, don't use the elevator, use the stairs is the thing. Well, it's the same on a cruise ship, except the reason why, in addition to fire and the, you know, the elevator acting like a big chimney, essentially, what can also happen is the elevator can get stuck very, very easily. If I recall, one of the crew who died was an entertainer who was a violin player, and the muster sounded. Everyone went to their muster station, emergency muster stations. He left his prize violin down below in his cabin, and he said he'd run down real quick. Things don't look too bad. He'd run down real quick and grab his violin. And he took the elevator back up just as the ship started listing over. And elevators, you know, you might be familiar with the general gist of it. There's a big winch on top and there's a box that goes up and down. But the thing that guides the box up and down are these runners. And they're well-greased steel runners. They're a bit like railways, on, you know, that a train might have, essentially. But instead of wheels, like on a train, it's just fixed girders and tracks and stuff. And if the ship leans over more than, I don't know, however many, 5-10 degrees, I really don't know the technical limits, the steel on steel, the winch on top isn't strong enough to drag steel on steel like that. So this guy got trapped in an elevator with 3 passengers. And his prize violin, and they were all found there afterwards, you know, dead, unfortunately. you know, was it worth the violin? Obviously not, but people panic and know my prize thing and they don't, look, this is humanity. We don't think clearly in trying times sometimes. Indeed, on the cruise ship I was on, we'd often train and teach the crew for emergency procedures, that if we're abandoning ship, there is a team of people that go around cabin to cabin to make sure all the passengers are out. And a place that we teach the lads to check is under the bed and behind the curtains, because believe it or not, there has been cases in the past where the ship's alarm goes off, the general alarm, and it can be very, very scary, very loud. And never underestimate a person's ability to panic. They could be the most cool and collected person on the fair day, on the normal day, but then when the alarms start blaring, people just shut down. You can get angry with it all you want, but it's a simple phenomena. This happens, people. And so we teach lads to check beneath the bed and behind the curtains. And from what I recall, there's this thing called the nuclei of chaos. So you've a big crowd, and there's 100 people, 3%, 3 of them are going to panic. That's the nuclei of chaos. And then there's passive, and then there's active. And so, there's active and then passive. So, like, the active guys would be, if the nuclei, if I think it's 20 to 40% can be active. If the nuclei of chaos isn't controlled and talked to and talked down, if the crew aren't demonstrating a proficiency in their duties, people will start saying, oh, well, screw this, I know what to do, I'm a survivor, and they'll end up doing the wrong thing. And if that is not curtailed, that panic can spread. But if you have crew at every junction and they are trained to keep the crowd going, keep the crowd moving up the stairs, keep them moving towards their muster stations and don't let them back down again, that prevents the nuclei of chaos and the active guys kind of getting out of hand. And that's generally what happened in the Costa Concordia, although it wasn't flawless, no plan is ever. But yeah, it's a very, very sad, very sad event that is also very, very complicated. The more you look at it, the more you know about it, the more complex these things become. And this is true for all manners of life. Every job always has a lot more behind it than, you know, what you might see superficially. Warehousing seems like it could be one of the more simpler jobs, and maybe it is out there, I don't know, but it's actually a lot more complicated than you might think. You really have to manage your space, you really have to look down the line at the coming week to see what's going where. There's obviously a lot of commerce and accounting, and you know, we're busy, but I'm constantly learning new tricks and new elements about the business. I mean, always. And this is the same when I was at sea. I was always learning new things, and it's with hindsight I'm looking back at some of the elements of the industry, of the maritime industry, with the growing respect, I suppose. I mean, like, bureaucracy is a big part of it, you know. There's a thing called the International Safety Management, ISM, and that sounds like something a fella in his suit just invented just to justify his existence, you know. But actually, in actuality, it's a very interesting entity that is very heavily sourced in bureaucracy and insurance and politics, because it's an international thing. But all those entities pale in comparison to the real life practicalities of the maritime industry. And as I said somewhere else, 95% of the world's freight is carried by sea. 95%. And to quote The Wire, you don't fuck with the money. So the maritime industry is, I suppose, what's the best way to phrase it? The maritime industry is a very pragmatic, real world, real life, has to work entity that is up to its gills in health and safety and insurance and bureaucracy and this and that and the other, yet it still has to work, and things have to be safer because it's an insurance company's it's not in their best interest to have sailors die and have accidents happen, because they're the ones that have to pay for it. It's actually cheaper for them now to ensure it's safe working conditions and that ships are up to standard. And a great way to check this is to financially incentivize local authorities everywhere around the world to rigorously check every ship that comes in. So look, okay, some slip through the cracks. That's just a given. That's life. That's how this world works. There's always something slipped through the cracks. But generally speaking, I mean, I suppose there could be a bigoted stereotype out there that if a ship was going to a third world country, that the level of inspection and whatnot would be subpar to other places. But in actuality, is third world countries sometimes have far more rigorous inspections because they want the money. You know, they're financially incentivized to make sure that these ships coming in are safe and to set to a certain standard, which is, I'm actually okay with that, you know. It can be a balls at the time because nothing's ever perfect on a ship. That's life. They're just too big. They're too vast, too complicated for everything to be working absolutely perfect. But there is an awful lot of leeway there, you know. An awful lot of leeway. And I did mention on a previous podcast that I was going to try to do an overlay between real life and or land life and the maritime. And this is one of the windows that I'd be investigating. You know, how can you combine insurance and bureaucracy and politics and have a very, very efficient needs to work system, I suppose would be the way to phrase that. But that also said, obviously there's disasters and mistakes, and MAIB. I might actually do another episode where I just talk about MAIB reports because they're so interesting. They're really amazingly interesting. I know, look, I don't want to be, you know, sounding excited or happy that people get hurt and property is damaged and environments are, you know, damaged, but they are very interesting, and they're a very rather marvelous window into the complexity of life and how slow moving things like ships end up hitting each other. I mean, that's what people scratch their heads over quite an awful lot, is you have the entire ocean around you and you still manage to hit each other. And how they manage to hit each other is interesting, because they are hitting each other. That's incredible. Once you go through the little lines of things that lead one to another, this error chain, very, very interesting thing stuff. But anyway, I'm gonna move away from that now, and I'm gonna talk about a little bit something I've been interested in since I was a 13 year old boy. And some of you might have heard of it. It's my favorite story. It's my favorite lore, I suppose. Might be the way to phrase that. One second, take some Vit Hit. Juice myself up. I love it, Ed. Oh, right. So, my favorite story is Warhammer 40,000. 40K. Now, this, straight off the bat, some people that might be listening to it might roll their eyes. It's growing bigger. I'll tell you how it started. Back in the 70s, there was this crowd called Games Workshop, and they were making all these interesting board games that are dice-orientated and turn-based and all this and that. And I think Rogue Trader and there was a few other ones like that. You know, that Space Hulk, that you're... It's a sci-fi setting, so like Space Hulk was, you're going through this old spaceship and you have to clear it out of all the aliens, and that was 70s and 80s, and I think in the mid-80s, the Warhammer tabletop game first started coming out, and essentially what that was you buy these little figurines, they're only about an inch high, and there's all these different factions and species and weapons and armor and tanks and, you know, all this. And you buy this blank plastic or steel figurine and you paint it up to the colors that you want. So your army is all the, you know, all the same type of, you know, character and chapter and whatever. And you put them on the tabletop and you have a measuring tape and you have dice and you make up your own kind of terrain and you have your little battles, you know, and you just slowly build up your armies. You don't really understand the rules at the first because they're so feckin' complicated, but slowly, slowly you get the hang of them. And I used to play every Friday with my cousin. Really, really enjoyed it. We did it for years and years and years. And but it's not just a tabletop game. It's there's all of this incredible lore behind it. I mean, it's huge. It's vast. It's intricate, complicated, practically impossible to know at all. Increasingly expanding, changing regularly, retconned and all this, so it's hard to keep up. But it is a fantastic story, and it's if you have a love for fantasy and particularly say sci-fi, science fiction, you got to love the 40K. It's like, well, I suppose in this current setting, this current day setting, 40 I think is 42,000 years in the future. I think is where the timeline currently is. 40,000 years in the future. So the year is 42,000. Humanity is beset upon all at all sides by aliens and demons and all this type of stuff. I'll get into them in a minute. But it has its own genre. I don't know, did they come up with them themselves or was it given it to them? But the genre is called grimdark. Everything is grim and everything is dark, and it's not a nice place to live. You'd maybe with Star Trek or something like that, you might be, I wouldn't mind living in the Star Trek universe. It seems really nice and everyone seems to be chilling out and getting along grand. There's the odd fight and all that, but you know, humanity is actually rather nice, a nice old bunch. Not so in the 40K. It's essentially a fascist regime that is very similar, a bit like if the Catholic Church was intergalactical fascist regime, but instead of Jesus Christ, they have different characters and all this and all that. You know, they have these high Gothic kind of cathedrals, and their ships are these kind of Gothic looking kind of behemoths that are kilometers long. And it's very, very grim and very, very dark. It's a place you would not like to live. No one wants to live. Even if you're like a planetary governor or some guy who's really high up, you mightn't even want to live there. But I digress, because the story is a long one. So the start of the story is actually 60 million years ago. And which is great. That's a very long story, you know. I mean, a story that starts 60 million years ago has already caught my eye. And the general idea was there's these dudes called the Old Ones floating around the place, and no one really knows what the Old Ones looked like, but we know that they were floating around the place, and they were creators. Essentially, they were like these demigod type beings that were, you know, planting trees here and putting a bit of life there and making this planet nice and that planet nice. And I think the first race of people they made were the Eldar, or the Eldari. You're not going to call them Eldar anymore because of copyright reasons, if I understand it. But they're called Eldari. And essentially, these are very humanoid guys. And they're a bit like the elves, space elves, essentially. Kind of, if you want to get a Lord of the Rings kind of vibe off it. And they had, like, you know, they're very elegant and had these beautiful cities. And they're fantastically educated. And they're all psychers, you know, they... magic and all this type of stuff. And that Old Ones were kind of chilling out with them, and they're having a bit of crack and whatever. But at the same time, there was this crowd that kind of formed on their own 2 feet, essentially, and they're called the Necrontyr. And these guys were also rather human-like, but unlike the space elves, the Eldari, they weren't mortal. So the Eldari were essentially immortal. A few of them died, obviously, but they're essentially immortal. And the Necrontyr had a bad old batch of it. They were born next to a star that had high radiation and was essentially cooking them, and they all died at 40. They got riddled with the cancer, and no matter what they tried, I don't know, did someone not tell them about sunscreen maybe, but they couldn't shift the cancer. They kept dying at 40. And they approached the Old Ones and they said, come here, Old Ones, look, is there any chance you could like make us not die from cancer really young? And the Old Ones said no, for some reason. I don't know why, they just did. And that pissed off the Necrontyr. And they said, right, so, fuck you. And they went off in a big mad war against the Old Ones. And the Old Ones went, no, that's not happening. And the Necrontyr got the shite bait out of them. And they got the shite bait out of them so bad that they went off and started a civil war. And they even screwed themselves over more. And so that was fine. I think they might have tried another couple of times. I'm not too sure. I can't quite rightly remember. But the Necrons here, I think they're in the middle of a civil war. And one of them anyway, I noticed this weird kind of entity feeding off a star, a local star, a sun. And space jellyfish, essentially. A big space jellyfish motherfucker that was eating a star. And the Necron here got a bright idea to put this space jellyfish kind of thing into a metal body. And that was great for them initially, because once they put the space jellyfish jobby into this metal body kind of thing, you know, the entity that was standing before them was nearly godlike in power. It was incredibly powerful, incredibly killy, very, very hungry, and very amiable to the requests of the Necron here, you know, that they wanted to live forever. They wanted immortality. And they, the Necron here caught a few more jellyfish and put them into bodies. And these guys were called Catan, C-T-A-N. And they kind of said to the Necron here guys, right, look, We have a solution for you. It's not the best, but it'll make you immortal, and it'll make you really killy, and you get to kill the old ones, and we get to eat the old ones, and it'll be great. Do you know what? That'd be fantastic. And the Necron here had a big boss called the Silent King, and he said, okay, let's do that. So, silently. And the Catan said, right, in you go to this big kind of foundry, this big machine, and the Catan discovered that they had a taste for souls that a star couldn't quench. They got the taste for delicious souls. And so they ate all the souls of the Necron here, and they put their remaining consciousness into these silver, metallic, shambling robots, you know, that they're just a husk of their former selves with these baleful, glowing green eyes. Oh, horrendous looking, and practically immortal, as promised, but no longer living. And so, you know, checks and, you know, the unintended consequences, and the whole population of the Necron here got turned into this robot type thing called the Necrons now. But it meant that they were super badass kill machines now, and the old ones and the Eldari found themselves in the back foot, getting pushed across in this massive war called the War in Heaven. And the old ones started kind of panicking a bit, going, what the fuck is going on here? And the Catan were just these ultra killing machines, and eradicating everything that they were coming near with these like star ending weapons, and all very, very epic. But the Eldari were, you know, they were sharp enough as well, and they had all this psychic magic, and they were fighting back, but the old ones were kind of going, oh, this isn't enough, lads. We're going to need some more. So they invented this crowd called the Gork, which are, you know, if you know your fantasy, are going to be orc-related, and they're really, really killy, and really, really smashy, and really, really strong. But the whole time, the Catan are acting the bollocks, and the Necrons and the Silent King were getting kind of more and more sick of the Catan, until eventually the Necron said, do you know what? We'll just fuck them up. And so they convinced the Catan to start eating each other, that the souls of the Necrons and the souls of the Eldar they were killing were but just a small taste of what they really could be having. And so the Catan started eating each other, and that culled their numbers quite a bit, until eventually there was only four or five of them left. And then the Necrons had the technology and the capability to shatter them. So they shattered those guys, and they turned them into shards. So each guy, I don't know, has how many shards. Could be 10, could be 100. Each Catan demigod has like 100, was shattered into 100 shards. And the Necrons, being the Necrons, being pragmatic fellas, turned those shards into batteries for power generation. Now, take that, you Catan bollocks. Which is a nice little twist. And so anyway, the Necrons decide to go to sleep for 60 million years, and they fuck off. And the Eldar are kind of left to their own devices for 59.9 million years. I don't know how long the War in Heaven lasted, but there's tens of millions of years by themselves, to themselves, to their own devices, and they got bored, as you can well imagine. And like, you know, the Necrons, they have this, they look really cool. It's kind of like a, they have this ancient Egyptian kind of thing going on there. Yeah, they're robots, but they have all these kind of scarabs and, you know, hieroglyphs and, you know, Egyptian iconography and pyramids and tombs, and it's really, really cool. So they're all to sleep, and then the Eldar are kind of doing their own thing. And, you know, fast forward, you know, 59.8 million years into the future, and humanity is budding. And but the Eldar, you know, in that time, are a large portion of their population are turning into degenerates, getting very, very, very dirty. And so anyway, as they're getting dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, portions of their population get a bit worried and disappear. They fake off. And see, the thing is, like, this magic I was talking about earlier, the warp, there were psychers, they could move things and shoot things and read minds and stuff. The thing they're harnessing essentially is a thing called the Immaterium, the warp. It's essentially like a universe that's kind of an alternate universe that's overlaid with ours, that's kind of, you know, there's pockets that interact, but you can't, you know, other than that, the Immaterium has no sway over the real world. But in this soup, this kind of warp soup, there was these entities that were semi-solid, you know, like they were kind of just soupy at the start, but particularly when humanity, particularly with this war in heaven, they kind of started taking a form a bit more. I mean, there's three big guys at the start. There's Khorne, which is like the blood god. No, they're not actually, well, they're called gods, but they're not actually gods. They're just very, very powerful entities that have powers and, you know, capabilities that might seem godlike to us, but I don't think there are. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but they're called the Chaos Gods. And the big guy is Khorne. He's blood for the blood god. He's a skull throne. He doesn't care from whence the blood flows, just as long as it flows. So if you're a follower of this guy, doesn't matter if you bleed out and die, or if your enemy bleeds out and die, just as long as someone bleeds, you know, that's what he likes. Mad bastard. The second fella is a guy called Nurgle, and he's the god of like pestilence and rot and disease and all this, and he's a big bloated pussy toad looking guy. Then the third fella is Zeech, and he's like the master of fate, essentially. Every conspiracy has his hand behind it, and you know, they were rather indistinct, unrealized kind of at the very, very start, but they kind of got more solid as the years kind of trundled on. And then when humanity raised its ugly, beardy, balded head, these chaos gods started going, yeah, no, we got something going on here, boys. Because we loved killing, and we loved conspiring, and we loved, you know, we had loads of diseases, bubonic plagues, and so I might be getting this slightly wrong, but the chaos gods kind of started becoming a bit stronger when humanity kind of came onto the table. And as far as the story goes, 11,000, I think it was maybe 15,000 years before today, you know, humanity was quite like what we are now. And as far as the lore goes, as far as I remember, there was like these 100 shamans or shamans, or however you pronounce that word, voodoo guys, somewhere in Turkey, right? South Turkey, if I remember correctly. And they could kind of see into the future. They were kind of psychic-ish. They were tuned into this warp kind of carry on. And they could see the future, that humanity was going to be beset upon all sides by all these monsters and aliens and threats galore. And that the only way to survive was if they combined all their powers into one individual, which is what they did. I think they kind of did a ritual mass suicide, essentially, and they became one person. We'll call the Big E, Giga Chad, Mega Human. And he immediately went into hiding. If I remember correctly, his base was in the Himalayan mountains somewhere. So he went into hiding, and, you know, the future trundled on. We went through our current period of technology. And then going forward, we went into eventually the golden age of humanity. The whole time, the Big E, I will call him Big E for now, was hiding away in the Himalayan mountains building up as armies, essentially. And we went through the golden age of humanity. I think it's maybe near 10,000 to 15,000. We developed like AI. Essentially, we figured out how to use the warp to travel faster than the speed of light. The idea is you have a spaceship, and you'd get a dude to essentially open a gate, and the ship would sail into this immaterium, the warp. It's essentially hell, but you'd have like this special force field to stop these hell entities getting into your ship, essentially. And you could travel tens of thousands of light years in but a few months, maybe not days or minutes, but months. But like time doesn't behave the same in the warp, and so that's how you can travel such distances. But the whole time the Eldar were getting dirtier and dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. And then humanity has spread itself all across the galaxy now by this stage, say by the year 20,000. But there's a civil war, right? There always is. So the AI, the artificial intelligence, revolts and kills loads of people, loads and loads and loads of people. And there's a huge, massive intergalactic space fight. Great stuff. You know very little about it. It's kind of obscured in history. And eventually humanity wins out. But the price is high. And we're getting more and more psychic. You see, the warp is becoming more and more active. And the Eldar are getting more and more dirty. Until they get so filthy. I mean, they just fly off of a cliff of degeneracy. And they get so, so, so dirty that they spawn. They spawn a new chaos god. And it's the chaos god of the dirty. Slaanesh is the new chaos god. And like Khorne is this big red spiky blood guy that sits on a massive throne with a massive spiked grin. And Nurgle is this toad like kind of bubbling and pulp, disgusting guy. And Zeech is this kind of shapeshifter kind of bird looking like fella. Excuse me. But Slaanesh is kind of like this weird, I suppose, nearly hermaphrodite kind of entity. It's both male and female, and it's the god of pleasure and pain. And when this god was born, warp storms erupted all around the galaxy. And so just after this huge artificial intelligence civil war uprising, humanity is just after dusting itself off, and this warp storm activity kicks in, and all of the Milky Way galaxy it's set only in the Milky Way. All of the Milky Way is cut off from each other. They used to have great lines of communication. Now every solar system is isolated and left to the whims of aliens and brigands and whatever. And this is a really interesting part of the story for me, because very, very clever. The more welcoming and the more humane societies that were granted isolated but still potentially flourishing through their own farming and whatnot. Oops, sorry, hitting the microphone. Once these psychers really started coming onto the scene en masse, they were like, hey, no, they're people too, guys, don't be really mean to them, they're not a bad, just because he can move something with his mind, or just because he can read minds, doesn't mean he's a bad guy. And, they're right, they didn't mean they were bad guys, but this is a grimdark setting, and through no fault of their own, these psychers could become portals to hell, which is not what you like. So, once this storm started happening, the guys just started essentially exploding. If you were a psyker, you exploded, and in the bloody mess that's left behind, this is a portal to hell, and all these horrific demons started spilling out and consuming the world and killing everyone. But, interestingly, the less tolerant societies, the ultra-religious, shall we say, burn the witch, burn the witch. Well, actually, they were saved from the portals of hell opening up on their planet because they were killing all the people that they could accidentally turn into such an entity. And that really set... So all the accepting and open people got slaughtered by demons, and all the unaccepting and, you know, burn the witch type people were saved, you know? Which I thought was a really good twist, like, to make it even extra grim dark. And and then Earth, the Holy Terror, it's called, Planet Earth, it goes into its own civil war, and the seas are boiled away, and what's left is this post-apocalyptic kind of barren wasteland that's predominantly radiated desert from all the nuclear bombs we've been dropping. And there's techno-barbarians, they're the guys in charge now, techno-barbarians, which sounds amazing. And it's now the Big E decides to come out of his Himalayan mountain base. I think this the year is like late 20,000s, maybe early 30,000s in the future, you know. Excuse me. And he has this big army that he's been making over the thousands of years, and he marches out and starts conquering planet Earth. And I mentioned earlier on, so this Big E guy, he declares himself the emperor of mankind at this stage. But I stay with the Big E. He'd been hiding since 15, you know, if he'd been hiding for nearly 30,000 years, maybe more. But he did pop his head up every so often. And there was one time where an element of, you remember these Catan, these space jellyfish type things? A shard of this Catan came to Earth somehow. And this shard was called the Void Dragon. And as far as I'm aware, in this Warhammer 40k universe, the mythology of dragons in human storytelling and history was actually ignorant people at the time witnessing the Void Dragon coming down, and the big emperor, the big E, you know, in a blinding shot of light, bait the shite out of it and brought it to Mars, as one does. And so anyway, the 30,000 years in the future, we're still not at the 40k bit yet, but 30,000 years in the future, the emperor Big E sets out, conquers Terra, the warp storms start dying off, communications are opening again, he's building up his fleets, he has these genetically modified super soldiers as his main guys, space marines, and he decides he's going to make 20 sons called Primarchs, and each of them have their own special ability and special strengths and weaknesses. But before they can be born, their pods, their growing pods, if you want to call them that, are snatched away by the gods of chaos and flung into the far corners of the galaxy. And so the emperor, he was going to go on a great crusade anyway to reunify humanity, and now he has to reunify humanity and collect all his sons, all 20 of them, which he slowly does. And, you know, it's interesting because, like, someone made the point in some common thread that as powerful as this emperor guy was, he couldn't step out during the height of technology for humans because he'd just been evaporated. That's how powerful the humans' weapons was at the time. But anyway, after the golden age, there was the dark age, and after the dark age, out comes the emperor, Big E. And from his emergence, he starts setting out into the galaxy, conquering again, and all these aliens. And the Gork I mentioned earlier are now called the Orc. They're just green dudes that are, you know, pretty tough, really, really tough. They're very, very interesting. Really, really fun. A really fun alien race that they just love fighting. A bit like my cat Jag. A bit of Orc in him. He just loves the old fighting. But this emperor guy is, he's actually an atheist. He's anti-gods, doesn't like gods, and he's anti these chaos guys. So his logic is, if I can get humanity to stop believing in gods, these dudes will stop being real, because there's no one to feed them. Like, you know, these chaos dudes are getting sustenance from humans' behavior and this, that, and the other. So if you can isolate them, they'll die away eventually. And these old ones I mentioned earlier, they had a system of travel in called the Webway, which essentially is like a separated place from both the universe, the materium and immaterium between the warp and regular reality. And it was the Emperor's hope to get all of humanity into this thing and so eventually starve out these chaos entities. There's a great book called The Last Church. I haven't read it, but I heard a bit about it, and it's a conversation between the Big E and the last priest on Earth. You know, the death of religion, essentially, the last church. And no, obviously all this backfires. he tries to push the imperial truth, which there is no god or gods, and it's just science, essentially. And most people go with that, to be fair. But the chaos gods get their little, they get their hands dirty, and they mess with the emperor's plans. And his favorite son, Horus, who's greatest skill is diplomacy and reading his brothers, he gets corrupted, and he corrupts half of your man's the Big E's sons, and there's a big civil war called the Horus Heresy. And by the end of that civil war, Holy Terra is besieged, but they're fought off. But Horus is killed, but the Emperor is mortally wounded and placed in this thing called the Golden Throne. And this Golden Throne is a technological relic. No one really understands what it does. You know, the Emperor understands a few things of what it does, but he kind of puts his dying corpse on the Golden Throne, and kind of a stasis field is activated. A stasis field being like it freezes time somehow in this area that it's surrounded. But and that's where the Emperor is today. He's interred on this Golden Throne, kind of a rotting corpse, frozen in time. A huge psyker that is constantly being fed souls of other psykers. So as I said, an untrained or untapped psyker can become a portal to hell. So it's become the Imperium's prerogative to collect as many psykers as possible. So they have a vast network of informants. You know, the Inquisition is a part of it, and there's this thing called the Black Ships, and the Black Ships are these psyker nulled ships that collect up all the psykers that are popping up all around the place. And you know, if they're any good, they're kept. If they're not, they're fed to the Golden Throne. 1,000 psykers a day must be fed to this Golden Throne to keep the Emperor alive. And it's something else he's doing called the Astronomicon, I think it's called. Essentially, it's a psychic beacon in the warp that navigators transiting the warp in their spaceships can use as to help them navigate through the tumultuous and maelstrom of you know, sailing through hell, essentially, which is so grim, so dark. Oh, brilliant, very good, absolutely love it. And so that brings us to the year 42,000, which is where the story is today. And there's aliens, and there's the orcs, which are the green guys. There's these tau, which are these blue guys, but they're very technologically advanced. There's the tyrannids, which are the ultimate evil guys that just are these bugs that consume everything that comes across them. They're called the Great Devourer. And they're an awful lot of fun. And there's the Eldari and the Dark Eldari. The Eldari are the good guys at the start, and the Dark Eldari now are the byproduct that when they did the big dirty and spawned the god of the dirty, they stayed at the dirty. all sorts of tortures and everything like that. And you know, there's obviously humanity, but humanity is split in two. There's the regular humanity, which is kind of the good guys, but also the fascist regime. And then there's the really bad guys, which are the chaos dudes, who are all these cultists and blood worshippers and all this and all that. So there is no good guys. There's no real good guys in this story. There is elements of good, people doing good and whatnot, but, like, you know, if you want to call their overarching behavior good, I don't think so. I mean, like, ever since this artificial intelligence civil war, AI has been banned, and so, but people still need robots and servants and stuff. So they have a thing called a servitor, and a servitor is kind of like a robot that you might imagine in some sci-fi that is picking up your lunch and bringing it over to you, or doing a job that humans aren't meant to do. But in actuality, it's mostly human, just with some cyborg attachments and stuff, and you're hoping that the poor bugger's mind has been wiped before it becomes a permanent Oh God, I mean, it's dark, like it's really, really dark, because like these servitors, they get thrown into all sorts of terrible, terrible jobs, and you're told that most of them are criminals, but given the number that's needed, there's probably a lot of them aren't criminals. But yeah, very grim, very dark, but it's a great story, right? It's something I've always enjoyed. Anyway, so look, this is actually my probably my longest podcast yet. Genie, Mac, it's an hour and 10 minutes. That's a lot longer than I was anticipating. So I'm going to leave it there. It's great. As I said, I do enjoy this process. I got the new laptop, but I've also got some video editing software, and I'm going to be putting more stuff up on YouTube, more videos. I just finished carving a bit of slate there recently, and I videoed elements of the different parts of the job, so I'm going to post that the next day. Guys, an unusual episode. I hope I didn't bring you too down with the Casa Concordia at the start, but it's an interesting topic that I found myself talking about last night. I'm going to schedule another beer episode where I don't know what I'm going to talk about, because I did enjoy last night, and it's unfortunate, very unfortunate, you couldn't hear me drinking my delicious Dutch Gold. But there's always another day. Guys, thanks so much for joining me, and we will see you later. Bye.